Okay, so we are studying about King Hezekiah right now as part of our overall study of these books that record the history of Israel, and we've been involved in that part of the study of the kings of Israel and Judah, and now gotten to Hezekiah, king of Judah, and as we have seen, now we are leaving that 208-year period of time where there was a divided kingdom that was after Solomon's death, where the Lord gave 10 tribes to King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, starting with him. And so there was a separate king that ruled over those 10 tribes that was to the north of Judah and Benjamin that were ruled by the descendants of King David through Solomon. And so the Lord preserved David's throne in that line, that royal line that had gone from David to Solomon, and that is maintained all the way through to the end of the physical kingdom of Judah that we're getting closer to now. But we'll finally end with Zedekiah being the last of the kings of the southern kingdom. But the northern kingdom and those 10 tribes started that were ruled first by Jeroboam. Going back to what we've already seen there, we know that under Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and who we've noted before, his last name almost, it seems like from the scriptures, every time we read his name, it's Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. I mean, that's like his full name. But I mean, that's what he's known for. And he made Israel to sin by creating an entirely new religion. So he was a founder of a denomination, as he created a separate religion for his kingdom, expressly with the purpose to prevent them from going to Jerusalem, from following the commandments of God. In his mind, that was going to keep them from turning to follow Rehoboam, because that was the rival capital. So he didn't believe God's promise that he would preserve Jeroboam's throne like he had preserved David's if he would keep his commandments. God gave him that promise. He didn't believe it. So he tried to handle matters his own way and secure his throne his own way. And he chose wicked means to do so. And of course, it had the exact opposite result. It led to the destruction of his kingdom. And I mean, as soon as his son became king, Baasha wiped out the entire family of Jeroboam, like God said he would do as that punishment. But then every king after him of the northern kingdom, that were all wicked. Jeroboam was the first, and all the ones after him, which included, as we saw, Omri and Ahab, that wicked family, and Ahab's two sons that also reigned as kings. One of the very low points in the history of Israel under the kings with that dynasty of Omri that was included there. But all of them, it tells us the successors to Jeroboam on the throne of Israel walked in the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. None of them repented of that. And that carried all the way through to the beginning of the reign of King Hezekiah, with the last of the, there were 19 total kings of that northern kingdom, starting with Jeroboam all the way through to Hoshea. And it was during Hezekiah's reign, the earlier years of his reign over Judah, that Hoshea, his kingdom fell as the Assyrians came and besieged Samaria and then took it. And so Hezekiah was a witness to all of that. But the Assyrian Empire was not introduced to Hezekiah merely through their coming in and conquering the northern kingdom, because now Hezekiah is on his own. And all of this is recorded in 2 Chronicles 18, which is the focal point of our study now. But the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel that we read about in chapter 17, it's tied into Hezekiah's reign, and we have a repeat, a summary of it here in 2 Chronicles 18. I keep saying 2 Chronicles, we're in 2 Kings 18. We have looked at 2 Chronicles 29, chapters 29 and 30 in parallel up to this point. And we have some more to look at in chapter 31 that follows what we're studying in 2 Kings chapter 18. So forgive me for the mixing those up with my mouth. But anyway, 2 Kings 18 repeats some of that summary information about the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel, and particularly highlighting that the reason for it in verse 12, where he said, "Because they obeyed not the voice of the Lord their God, but transgressed his covenant and all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded, and would not hear them nor do them." I mean, that was God's reason for bringing that punishment on them, and after 208 years. I mean, it was 208 years of 19 kings of continuous sin and rebellion against God. Can anyone accuse God of being not being long-suffering? Well, he just didn't give them enough chances. We see that he sent prophet after prophet after prophet, warning them, pleading with them. How many opportunities were they given to repent? He brought various punishments on them, and we've looked at all of that too, where he brought punishments on them, and part of that was to get their attention, to encourage their repentance. He even gave them blessings and showed him his goodness to try to get them to respond to that. But every effort the Lord made, other than a few exceptions, for the kings and the majority of the people, they ignored all of that. And so now they were destroyed. Hezekiah is king of Judah while this is going on. So now from this point onward, Hezekiah and his successors over the ruling over the kingdom of Judah, Judah is now by herself, along with the tribe of Benjamin. And the remnant of those other tribes, ones that had come and joined themselves to them over the years. But now we're back to one kingdom again, because 10 tribes of the nation of Israel are gone, lost forever, never to return. No, they weren't preserved. They had lost their, long ago, they had lost their distinction as God's people by rejecting him. And then they were taken away by the Assyrians and scattered in various portions of the Assyrian Empire. Well, they were not, there was no distinction as God's people among them. So they just blended in. They were of the world, and when they got scattered in those other places, they just blended in with wherever they were. And they were lost to history from then. That's one reason they're referred to among historians as the lost tribes of Israel. Well, they were spiritually lost, and then they became physically lost in the sense that they were scattered and just blended in with wherever they were, and that was the end of them. So Judah's alone now. Hezekiah is facing the threat of Assyria, the same Assyrian empire that had conquered the northern kingdom of Israel, but had been on the rise from before that. Hoshea's predecessor, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the next to the last king of the northern kingdom, the Assyrians came in when he was started coming in and invaded his land when he was king, and took away those, conquered the territory on the east side of the Jordan River where the inheritance was for Reuben and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh, and those two and a half tribes were taken away, as well as the very northern tribes in the area of Galilee. They were taken away into captivity by the Assyrians under Pekah. So really, Hoshea ruled over, even though it was the majority of the people, it was still only about half the tribes of those 10. But the Assyrians did all of that. Also had conquered those neighbors of Israel. So this is the situation that Hezekiah is now facing, as we were told then in verse 13, that in his 14th year, as king, that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. So here's this mighty Assyrian empire conquering all of these nations, conquering the northern kingdom of Israel that has now fallen. Now they've invaded the land of Judah and taken all the fenced cities of Judah. I mean, what were the fenced cities? And what does that mean? They have nice little picket fences around the cities that look real cute. I mean, is that, what does it mean when it says the fenced cities?
Fortified.
The fortified cities. I mean, those were the cities of defense. I mean, that's where they had their soldiers. Those were the strongholds that were designed to meet and resist any enemy invaders. Well, if all of your fence cities fall, what defense do you have left as far as soldiers and strongholds? It's gone. So what is left now in Judah? Well, here's Hezekiah. He's in his capital city of Jerusalem. That's all that's left standing. And so when we look at the situation he's facing, here he is in Jerusalem with this Assyrian empire all around him. And he's now reduced to his capital city. And we asked the question last week when we were looking at part of this, that, I mean, from a human standpoint, if we were just to look at this situation, what chance would Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, have to hold out against, to resist and not fall to the Assyrians? One of the great world empires of history. I mean, what would this one city of Jerusalem be able to do? I mean, what would their odds be given that they would be able to hold out and not fall to the Assyrians? I mean, who would have given any chance whatsoever that Jerusalem would not be conquered by the Assyrian Empire? I mean, just looking at it from a strictly human standpoint, I mean, we would give them zero chance, which is what the Assyrians themselves were giving them. As we read the words of Sennacherib, that and what was in his thoughts there in Isaiah chapter 10. Won't hurt us to go back there for a moment, because we do want to revisit before we move forward here what he had promised and what he had warned them against in chapter 8. So we have several chapters in the book of Isaiah, keeping in mind that Isaiah the prophet was a contemporary of King Hezekiah. He was right there in Jerusalem with Hezekiah when all this is going on. Isaiah's career as a prophet of the Lord began much before Hezekiah's time. I mean, it included the time of the reign of Hezekiah's wicked father Ahaz. But Isaiah is there throughout the reign of Hezekiah. So we do read a lot about him and these events that are recorded in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles about Hezekiah's reign. There's a lot of information in the book of Isaiah about that. There are a lot of prophecies that came before Hezekiah's rule, which is very significant, because the question is Hezekiah going to trust the Lord? Is he going to believe the promises of God, and is he going to show his faith by doing what God said, by hearing him and obeying him, which is what God's definition of a living faith is? But in Isaiah chapter 10, we see the proud words of the Assyrian king that God plainly stated in verse 5 was the rod of his anger. He said, "O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff of their hand in their hand is mine indignation." So as God is introducing this particular prophecy through Isaiah, who is being given credit for what the Assyrians are doing? God. He refers to the Assyrian as the rod in God's hand. So God was using the Assyrians to do his work. He stated plainly in verse 6 that he was sending the Assyrians against a hypocritical nation and the people of his wrath. Verse 7, though, what was in the mind of the Assyrian king? Did the Assyrians and their ruler recognize that God was the one that raised them up to be this power that they were, and that God was the one using them in his hand as a tool, as an instrument of whatever for whatever purposes he had? Not at all. The king of Assyria thought he was doing all this on his own, just like people today think that they're doing all what they're doing on their own. And people don't recognize that God still has authority in this world, and that through Christ, God is ruling over the nations, and he's the one that has given us the powers that be today, just like he always has. We believe that because God says so, but people in this world and these nations don't believe that. The king of Assyria didn't either. Verse 7, howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. For he saith, and here's his boast, are not the princes altogether kings? So here's what he's saying to these other nations. You got your kings. I'm the king here. I got my princes. My princes are better than your kings. This is how he's bragging. Verse 9, is not Calmos Carchemish, is not Hamath as Arpad, is not a Samaria as Damascus? Ticking off a list of these capital cities of these nations that have already fallen to the Assyrians, that he's conquered. Look at all these. They're mine. I conquered them. Verse 10, as my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria. He's equating the God that Hezekiah is serving with those idols of Samaria, because Samaria's already fallen to him. Did they save Samaria? Of course they didn't. And he's looking around, did any of these so-called gods of any of these other nations save them? And in his mind, the God of Israel is merely one of these idols. Of course he's not. This is the true and living God that Hezekiah is serving. That is the one that has raised up the Assyrians, and the one that's going to make them fall ultimately. But he said in verse 11, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? Well, that's what he's boasting. That's what he thinks. But what was the answer to that question? Aren't I going to do to Samaria, Jerusalem, just what I did to Samaria? The answer is no, you're not. Because God is going to stand up for Jerusalem. And he's going to turn you back. He's not going to let you do that. But that's not what he thinks. He's going to find out the hard way. And we know that back in chapter 8, and this is very relevant to where we're studying now with Hezekiah, this is what God said before Hezekiah is ever king, back in the days of his father Ahaz in Isaiah chapter 8. Starting in verse 5, it says, the Lord spake also unto me again, saying, forasmuch as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloah that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son. Now this is what was going on among God's people. They were under Ahaz. They were looking to find deliverance from making alliances with these other nations or kingdoms around them. Ahaz was wicked, did not believe in God, didn't serve God, did not turn to God for his deliverance from these other nations that God was sending against him to punish him for his wickedness. So instead of learning the lesson, oh, why am I having this trouble? Oh, it's because I've angered my maker because I'm rebelling against him. Instead of recognizing that and then fixing the problem, because his problem was with God, not these nations or kingdoms that God was sending against him. But of course, he didn't learn the lesson and he didn't fix the real problem. So he was turning to these other men, these other kingdoms, to try to save him from the trouble that he was in, that God was bringing as punishment. But that's what God is rebuking here. So verse 7, he says, "Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory. And he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah. He shall overthrow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck. And the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel." And he's talking about what Assyria was going to end up doing to Judah. And the Assyrians were going to overflow their banks like a river flooding. How high would the waters go? Up to the neck. And as we've noted, you go higher than here, and then what happens? Well, you drown. Yeah, I mean, you get the neck. I mean, that's as high up above the floodwaters as you can tolerate before the waters end up drowning you. So, I mean, the Lord was using these words and describing what the Assyrians were going to do. They were going to be a flood, and how bad was it going to be? I mean, if you were standing in floodwaters, and I remember this was quite a few years ago, back when I was in college, and I was out west with my dad. We were traveling through Arizona, New Mexico, and they had across the desert, and they had one of their rare storms. But I mean, a real gully washer. But that doesn't rain a lot out in the desert, obviously. But when they do get a big storm, what ends up happening? I mean, a lot of that rain falls right there. But I mean, it goes through these dry gullies and things that normally you see, and there's no water in them. But when rain comes, I mean, all of that rushes down through those channels. And we were in a town where we had parked. I mean, the water was, it was very difficult to get our car to pass through. We had to find a high place. And I remember walking. We went to get something to eat. I think we went to Pizza Hut or something like that. But my dad and I were walking through the streets, but it was up. The water was up to our waist. We had our shoes off, carrying them in our hands. I think we should not have been out there, but because really you don't know how high it's going to go. We didn't get washed away, fortunately, or I wouldn't be here. But anyway, if you've ever been in any kind of floodwaters, I mean, you don't know how high those waters are going to go when you're in them. And as he's describing here, I mean, if you're there and the water's rising, it gets up to your neck, I mean, what are you going to be thinking? If this goes any higher, I'm done. But the Lord is telling me that's what they're going to do. I'm going to send the Assyrians through the land. They're going to be like that. But just before you drown, what does God say he's going to do? That's as high as they're going to go. So God's not going to let them drown. He's not going to let the Assyrians conquer Jerusalem. He's going to save the city. So God was already foretelling what the Assyrians were going to do, how deep the trouble was going to be, literally. But then God was going to save them. But what is he telling them not to do in order for God to save them? Well, not to rely on these other nations, not to try to make a confederacy with somebody else. Don't turn to men to solve this problem. Don't turn to these other nations to try to get them to bail you out and save you. If you turn to men and not me, what's going to happen? Well, then they're going to fall. So the condition for God's salvation here is that they trust him and do it his way and not turn to men. So that's the important point of that prophecy in Isaiah chapter 8 is it's going to relate to Hezekiah, because these words are going to be for him. He speaks them in Ahaz's day, but Ahaz is gone now. The flood's up to the neck, and it's Hezekiah who's the king. So he's going to have to hear these words and choose whether or not to believe them and obey what God is telling them to do. So right after that, verse 8, where he says that they were going to be up to their neck as a flood of waters, verse 9, he says, "Associate yourselves, O you people, and you shall be broken in pieces. And give ear, all you of far countries, and yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces." You turn to other men or nations, you're done. If you're going to try to fight your way out of this yourselves, you're done. Verse 10, he says, "Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand. For God is with us. For the Lord spake thus to me with a strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. So don't make a confederacy. Don't associate yourselves with these other nations and try to turn to them to save you from this trouble. And don't try to fight it. Fight your way through it on your own. You'll fall then. So God was very plain in those prophecies. Here's how bad it's going to be. I'm the one sending the Assyrians. Here's the reason why. Here's how bad it's going to get. But here's what I'm going to do then if you will do this and not do these other things. So this is for Hezekiah. Now, if you're there in Jerusalem, in those waters up to your neck, and you've got those words there that were spoken through Isaiah the prophet who's with you, right there at your side, are you going to believe those words that he spoke and really believe God is the one that said that and God's really going to do this? Or under that situation, as desperate as it is now, are you going to try to do something on your own? That's the question. Are you going to believe God and do what he says or not? Well, he is. That's the reason why earlier in chapter 18, when we were introduced to Hezekiah, how did the Lord describe this man? In verse 3, he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. As we've noted, he only makes a statement like that of all the kings that Judah ever had. The only ones that he describes in that way, walking in the ways of David, that was Jehoshaphat, Asa, Jehoshaphat, and now Hezekiah. And then Josiah will be the fourth and final one. And Judah also had 19 kings. The northern kingdom had 19. Judah has 19. But zero for 19 with the northern kingdom from Jeroboam all the way down to Hosea. Only 4 out of 19 of the kings of Judah did God describe in this way, that were fully righteous and walked in the ways of the Lord like David did. So when we look at the overall history of Israel under the king, spiritually speaking, was that a time in which they thrived? Or was that a time in which, for the most part, they followed wickedness? Well, that's the sad fact. They did. But this is one of these exceptions, and one that is very beautiful to read about, the faith that Hezekiah had. Because as he then says in verses 5 and 6, this is the characteristic of Hezekiah that he really highlights here, that he trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. For he clave to the Lord and departed not from following him, but kept his commandments which the Lord commanded Moses. And those aren't just light words, as we're seeing the very circumstances in which his faith, his trust in the Lord is being put to a test. And what a test. But he's going to pass this test because he's going to believe what God said. He's going to believe that God is going to turn away the Assyrians and save them. And he's not going to turn to other men. Now, a little bit further down in chapters 18 here in 2 Kings, the first response, when Assyria flooded through the land like God said they were, and all the fenced cities of Judah fell, and there's nothing left now except for Jerusalem, verse 14 says, and Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, to Lachish. So here they are. That's one of those fenced cities not far from Jerusalem that he's conquered. So Jerusalem would be next. So he's on their doorstep. He's up to the neck, saying, I have offended. Return from me. That which thou puttest on me will I bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria. So what's the first thing that Hezekiah did when the trouble has reached up to his neck? Well, here's the question. Does he turn to other men? He doesn't do that. That's what God said. If you do that, you're going to fall. He doesn't do that. But what does he do? Well, his first response is to, okay, what do you want from me? What can I give you to make you go away? And so he says, this much silver, this much gold. And then this is sad to read. I mean, he's stripping gold from the temple, including and he mentions specifically the doors of the temple. Now, when we think of the doors of the temple of the Lord in Hezekiah, what do we think about first? What came before stripping gold off of them to give to the Assyrians? What was the first thing that it told us that Hezekiah did when he became king? That was in 2 Chronicles 29. The very first act that he took after he became king was to open the doors of the temple, because his wicked father Ahaz, in serving all of his idols, had literally closed the doors of the temple. The temple of the Lord was cut off to the people of Israel. It was not even used. That's how far they had gone in turning away from Jehovah, their God. They literally closed up the temple. They were worshiping idols and all those high places and all those altars that he had filled Jerusalem with. Now, we saw after Hezekiah became king, the first action he took was to open the doors of the temple back, sanctify the priests and the Levites, have them cleanse the temple, make it available to be used to serve the Lord again. Of course, then right after that, then he had them to observe the Passover, and then all the people tore down all of those altars in high places. So he had a very deliberate sequence of actions that he took to turn the people away from all those idols. They repented of that, and they were turning back to the Lord under his righteous leadership. But oh, he opened up the doors of the temple again. But here's the same doors that Hezekiah had opened up a few years before, 14 years before. And now, sadly, the gold that was left on them, and the entire temple that Solomon had built, of course, was overlaid with gold. Much of it has already been stripped away and given to various nations through the periods of time when God sent enemies against them, but for punishment for their rebellion against him. There's been cycles of this before, as we just were talking about. So few of the kings of Judah were righteous. And so in the times of those wicked ones, which outnumbered the righteous ones by far, they had to face many of the enemies that God sent against them, as he had promised through Moses. If you keep my commandments, your enemy will come against you one way and flee before you seven ways. And he said, if you don't keep my commandments, you're going to go against your enemy one way and flee before them seven ways. That's in Deuteronomy 28. The Lord had promised that. It was a blessing to that they would God would deliver them from their enemies if they served him. But he was one of the curses was going to be that he would send their enemies against them if they did not keep his commandments. And we saw that same cycle through the entire 400 plus year of history of the judges. When they turned against him, that's what happened. And then they would finally repent, and then he would raise up a judge to deliver them and defeat their enemies, and then they would serve the Lord under that judge. And then when that judge died and that generation died out, the next generation would do what? Repeat the same pattern in rebellion, and then another enemy would come against them, and then here we go again. That was a cycle through the judges. I mean, it's even worse with the kings, because the leaders that God chose for them under the judges, how many of the judges were wicked? Zero. He gave them righteous. He chose the best of their nation to raise them up to be their leaders during those times. So that system that God had chosen for them, that they themselves rejected, they were the ones that said, well, no, we want to have a king over us. We want to be like the nations around us. And how did that work out? The same way it works out when we try to do things, we want to do things our way or a different way than God's way. So this is what led to all of these problems. But when they had these enemies that came against them under the kings of Judah, they would take gold out of the temple and give it to them. Who was the first one to do that? Anybody remember? And it's been a while since we studied Rehoboam, the very son of Solomon. So how long did this take? Solomon was the one, of course, that actually built the temple. So we have the Temple of Solomon, as it was referred to. That temple that Solomon built, his own son, Rehoboam, is the first one that starts taking gold out of it to deal with enemies that came against him because he had turned away from the Lord. In 1 Kings chapter 14, it says in verse 25, it came to pass in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He even took away all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. And King Rehoboam made in their stead brazen shields and committed them under the hands of the chief of the guard which kept the door of the king's house. And it was so when the king went into the house of the Lord that the guard bare them and brought them back into the guard chamber. So that's what Rehoboam did when the Egyptians came against him. The reason the Egyptians came against him because Rehoboam turned away from the Lord. So so Solomon's own son. So here's that glorious temple that Solomon made, and it takes one generation. His own son is the one that starts to take away the gold and things from it to give to an enemy that God sent against him because of his rebellion against God. So that was the beginning of this, and there were several other occurrences that we read about in the scriptures of other kings that did that. What about Hezekiah's own father Ahaz, who was the most wicked ruler that Judah had ever had up to this point, which is astonishing to read about one of the most righteous men of the Bible. Hezekiah had as a father one of the most wicked men of the Bible, but that was the way it was. But Ahaz, he also tried to, he's tried to get out of his troubles that were with God by turning to and making associations with other nations. He turned to the Assyrians to try to bail him out of his problems with the king of Syria and also Pekah, who was the king of the northern kingdom of Israel. So that, of course, didn't succeed at all because he was trying to do things that instead of solving his problems that he had with the Lord, he was doing things his way and not God's way, and it failed. Going back to for a moment to 2 Kings chapter 16, it tells us that verse 5, that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war, and they besieged Ahaz but could not overcome him. God wasn't going to let Jerusalem fall even under the wicked reign of Ahaz. Verse 6, and at that time, Rezin, king of Syria, recovered Elath, the Syrian, and drave the Jews from Elath, and the Syrians came to Elath and dwelt there unto this day. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Assyria and out of the king of hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house and sent it for a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria hearkened unto him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried the people of it captive to Kir and slew Rezin. And King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the fashion of the altar and the pattern of it according to all the workmanship thereof. And Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah the priest made it against King Ahaz, came from Damascus. So here he finds a new altar that he likes, and he's taking the altar from God's temple to join it to the pattern of this idolatrous altar. That's what he's doing when he's meeting the king of Assyria to buy him off with gold from the temple to have him to save him from the king of Syria and the king of Israel. I mean, Ahaz was special in a bad, bad way. But that's what he did. It tells us that, verse 17, King Ahaz cut off the borders of the bases and removed the laver from off them and took down the sea from off the brazen oxen that was under it and put it upon a pavement of stones. This is in the midst of all these things that he did when it tells us how he closed up the doors of the temple. This was a wicked man, but this was Hezekiah's own father. So the beginning, the stripping away of gold from the temple started with Rehoboam and it carried all the way through to the time of Hezekiah's own father, Ahaz. Would it be any wonder that one of the responses that Hezekiah would have when the Assyrians come up against him like that is, what can I give you to make you go away? And then when he says this much silver and gold, where is he going to get it? Well, he takes what couldn't have been much left from the temple and gives it to him. Now, is he violating God's commandment to not turn to other men or try to fight himself his own way out of this problem? No, but is this going to make the problem go away? This isn't the solution God had in mind. So he's not rebelling against the Lord's commandments. We maybe see something comparable when God told Abraham that he was going to make of his own descendants a great nation. Well, when God said that, was it clear to Abraham at first that that was going to be through his wife, Sarah? Well, Sarah then gave her maidservant Hagar to Abraham to be a wife, and she bore Ishmael to him. Well, that's what Abraham and Sarah and Abraham were thinking at that moment, but was that the plan that God had in mind when he first made the promise? No. And then that became clear, and God told him, no, this is going to be this. I'm going to give you a son through Sarah, and in Isaac will your seed be called. So at the very beginning, was all that real clear to Abraham? And they came up with a way that they thought would be in keeping with God's plan, and that was going to be the fulfillment of it. But of course, they were mistaken about that. And then God made that clear, and it went the way God intended. So sometimes, you know, sometimes when we're facing situations or tests in our own life, is it always going to be crystal clear at the very beginning? Okay, we're thinking, what's the right thing to do here? What is God's way? What do the scriptures say about dealing with a situation like this? It may not always be very plain or clear to us at the beginning of something like that. Okay, this is what I need to be doing. We might be kind of fighting our way through it at the first part to try to understand what's going on and what the right thing to do is. But as we're working our way through it, then we may start to see things more clearly. As we do that, do we make course corrections as we say, okay, I see this now, and the Lord says this over here? Are we continually searching and considering what he says, praying to him and looking for whatever that way of escape that God is going to provide through and the way he's going to work whatever it is for our good like he's promised? We have to keep working through those things, but we see that here with Hezekiah also. But the first action he takes, it's not a violation of God's commandments, but it's also not what God has in mind. Does Hezekiah plainly know at this point the very means by which God is going to save him? He didn't say that. He didn't say that in those passages, those prophecies in Isaiah. God hasn't revealed that yet. This is the means I'm going to use. This is the method I'm going to use. He hadn't told him yet that he's going to send one of his angels into their camp and kill 185,000 of their soldiers in one night. He hasn't told Hezekiah that that's what he's going to do yet. Hezekiah doesn't know that yet. He doesn't know the way. It's not that clear at this point. So his first action is, okay, give him what he's demanding with the silver and gold. But that's not going to be what's going to make him go away. In verse 17, it says, the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a great host against Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem, and when they were come up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is in the highway of the fuller's field. And when they had called to the king, there came out to them Eliakim the son of Hilkiah, which was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph the recorder, and Rabshakeh said unto them, speaking out of Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Thou sayest, but they are but vain words. I have counsel and strength for the war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me? Now behold, thou trustest upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt, on which if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, unto all that trust on him. But if you say unto me, we trust in the Lord our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah had taken away, and hath said to Judah and Jerusalem, ye shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? Now therefore I pray thee, give pledges to my lord the king of Assyria, and I will deliver thee 2,000 horses, if thou be able on thy part to set riders upon them. How then wilt thou turn away the face of one captain of the least of my master's servants, and put thy trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? And I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it. The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. These words of the king of Assyria's servant. I mean, some of these exact words we were reading virtually in Isaiah 10 when God said what was in the thoughts of the king of Assyria in all of this. And here he's saying, are you going to trust in Egypt? I mean, that was the mightiest neighbor that Israel could have turned to. But what did God tell the Judah and Hezekiah? Don't do that. Don't go to these other nations. Don't make a confederacy or try to go to one of these other nations. Egypt would have been first on the list. God had already told them so many times, don't go to the Egyptians to help you out. Well, Hezekiah's not doing that. God told him not to. So he knows that's the wrong move to make, and he believes that God said, I'm going to save you some other way, and if you go and try to make a confederacy, you're going to fall. Hezekiah believes that. He's not doing that. So the Assyrians are trying to discourage them from that, but that's not even necessary here because God's already told him not to do that, and he's not. And then he's making this argument, you think God's going to save you? Look what Hezekiah's done to all the altars of the gods of Jerusalem. He's torn them all down. They're going to be mad at you. They're not going to save you. And in fact, God has told me to come destroy you. I mean, that's all a big lie. They've heard about the actions that Hezekiah has taken with tearing down all these high places. Is there any understanding on their part the distinction between the God of heaven, the creator of all things, the true and living God versus these idols? There's no understanding or distinction with that at all. What has Hezekiah done? He's turned the people away from all those false gods to the true and living God. And so when he says he's told you to come worship at this altar at Jerusalem, that's to worship and serve the God of heaven, who is the one that will save them. So these words he's speaking are mixed up and showing the lack of understanding on his part. But did the silver and gold make him go away? Mm-mm. It didn't, of course. So here they are, up to the neck now with these words. And now Hezekiah is going to turn to God to find out, how are you going to save me from this? And he's going to follow him through. We're going to stop there as we're out of time now and pick it up here, Lord willing, next Sunday morning. Appreciate everybody being here for our time of study. And let's go to our Heavenly Father in prayer again as we close.